Welcome back to segment number two. We're crazy. We're crazy, but
we're... Yeah, we're going a lot. We're just going nuts here.
This is
going
to be episode four, for right. Anyone who doesn't know. Episode four of the Two Johns Sci-Fi Podcast.
Is that cheating, though?
Well, no. I mean, why is it cheating?
We're doing two episodes, and we're counting it. And instead of a two-hour episode, we just chopped it in half and did...
No, because the first episode was an hour.
Oh, yeah, I know, but... Same day.
We are now like doing bi-weekly. Just so people don't know, this it just so happens that this second segment is going to be the Nebula episode, our first annual.
Right.
But we're going to be doing bi-weekly now, and what's going to happen is we're going to actually stream both segments at once, and then we're going to split the audio up right. for release on iTunes 2 weeks apart.
Yeah.
So
it's half monthly and half bi-weekly.
Yes.
Broken up that way.
It's weird, but you know.
It's weird. But this, our subject is weird, so we're allowed to be weird.
Yes. So welcome to episode four of the Two Johns Science Fiction Podcast. And this is our first annual Nebula episode. So we're going to talk about Nebula's short format fiction nominees.
Right. The novelette and the short story.
And the short story, yes. So we are going to be... And I want to talk about that a little bit. I'm going to preface some of it because I want people to know that we're hard on most things.
Yeah.
You know, and
but we're hard on ourselves too when it comes to that stuff.
Yes. And so, you know, we only have really one objective when it comes to our critiques, and that is to look at what's good and what's bad.
Right.
Plain and simple.
Yep.
And obviously there's a level of subjectivity to that, but we try to use objective criteria as much as possible when, you know, evaluating this sort of thing.
Because otherwise you're just, if you don't have some criteria to hold yourself to,
right.
You're just, what are you doing?
It's criteria that we would hold ourselves to.
Yep.
When we write.
Yep.
So.
And we do that. You know, when we do share our stuff with each other, we ask each other, is like, do you really think this is sci-fi? Does
right.
this really qualify? Or is it?
Yes.
You know, so.
Yes. So we're going to talk about that. And I'm going to talk more specifically, briefly, I'm going to talk more specifically about the Nebulas. There are some things that people simply aren't going to like that I say.
Right.
And I'm kind of beyond caring.
But it's not like we're bashing on the Nebulas because we just reviewed a film based on a book that won the
yes.
Nebula, and we were very positive about it.
Yes. You know? But it's one of those things where, well, I can see that there's kind of an ecosystem when it comes to science fiction.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to the awards, the publication, and et cetera. And I'm seeing sort of a trend, it seems like, and it could just be me being paranoid or whatever, but I see a trend, or not really being paranoid, just kind of imagining it.
Right.
But there are workshops that produce writers, and those writers oftentimes go on to win Nebulas. And you're going to see oftentimes these writers who win Nebulas or who were published, they were once workshop graduates.
Right.
Okay, and you know, there was a time when people would say, oh, it's all loaded, it's all kind of rigged. But the truth is that it's an ecosystem. You know, it's like you have to produce writers, you have to produce science fiction writers in order for them to then be published science fiction writers,
right.
and then for them to become award-winning science fiction writers.
I mean, unless you just want to rely on the, you know, the natural environment to occasionally pop a weirdo in, like, which is what science fiction was for, like, 100-some years...
Well,
and
sort
you didn't
of.
Have that much.
Sort of. You had, like, John Campbell, who was friends with Isaac Asimov.
Right, they're a little bit of... were they friends before they started writing, though?
No, I think the writing brought them together.
Right.
So you have someone like Lee Brackett, you have someone like Isaac Asimov, you have E.E. Doc Smith, you have, like, a bunch of people from that era who were, like, the lost generation
right.
of science fiction,
right.
and they knew each other. And they published, you know, like John Campbell was like the iron-fisted editor of Asimov's, was now today Asimov's. And it was called Astounding Science Fiction and Fact back in those days. And that was how he cultivated, you know, who got published.
And that's different from what you're talking about now.
True.
Which is which they've taken a step back and they're sort of front-loading. It's the workshop is taking place of what used to be what happened in the actual publication, so...
And one of the things I'm noticing is that So just so that we so that we don't appear to be being just sort of subjectively just being
right
jackasses.
Right.
That doesn't mean we aren't jackasses, but not in this. Not in this.
Right.
We've got actual principles that we're talking about.
But we talk about the Frankenstein. We have this thing we call the Frankenstein
principle.
Principle. Yeah. Okay, and that is that if you took Frankenstein out of the story, well, I'll let you explain that.
Right. Well, I read it somewhere because this isn't our idea. You know, Frankenstein has been used as a sort of definition for science fiction by a lot of different writers, and somewhere I read that the whole point was that science fiction wasn't just window dressing in the story.
Right.
So how much would the story have to change if the science part were stripped out?
Yes.
And as you could imagine, even though Frankenstein itself, that story, can be read at two levels, the science level but also the human level of someone who reaches too far, if you strip the science out of it, the whole story's gone.
Right.
There's no story there anymore.
Right.
So that is, I mean, that's basically the Frankenstein principle in a nutshell, is that if you took the science out, would the story still be there?
Yes.
And if you can take the... if you can
would the story still be a science fiction story?
Would it
would
it still be a story?
True.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you could just do some light rewriting of a story and remove the science without dismantling the actual core story, that's not science fiction.
Right.
I mean, it may not mean it's a bad story.
Yes.
And, it may not mean that putting the science in that story is wrong in any way.
Right.
But what it does mean is that it's not... that story is not science fiction,
right?
Just because it has a few of the window dressings
right.
of science. And I would actually say that should count for fantasy as well.
Yes.
It's just because you have once or twice a magical thing happens in a story doesn't make it a fantasy story.
Right.
It's this weird, creepy one-drop rule that people want to apply.
Right.
And I just don't think that's...
And we have some tropes that we're going to apply. We have some tropes that we're going to apply to some of the stories that we've read that we think are applicable.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm going back to what I was saying about the ecosystem is I'm seeing an instance in it, and I don't blame the writers, because many of the stories that we read this year and just we've read recently were excellently written stories.
Yeah, they're good stories.
But by our standards, not necessarily science fiction.
They're not science fiction stories.
Now you can say fantasy, but fantasy kind of doesn't really have any boundaries. And that's
right.
fine, but we also have our own objective boundaries about what's science fiction, and that is what we call rigorous science fiction, which means it doesn't have to be Andy Weir doing research over the Mars Project,
right.
and he's got every single detail right because
right.
he knows the director of NASA or whatever. There is an element where you're allowed to take some liberties, but the science should be a functional character in the story.
Right. It shouldn't be able to be just moved out of the story.
Right.
So
now we know that there is a boundary between science and science fiction, and that's totally okay. We're totally okay with fantasy. I prefer sword and sorcery, but there are some stories that are fantastical that I like also.
Yeah.
And then there's magical realism, which to me is just sort of crazy.
Right.
But anyway.
But you can't just have a regular story and at one point somebody has a conversation with a leprechaun,
right?
That could have been a bartender,
right?
There's no reason for it to have been a leprechaun, and then that's your fantasy foot in the door.
Yes,
that's completely unfair, and goes back to what I was telling you. We were discussing the ins and outs of this. What it reminds me of, and I've written it down here as a reminder, is what I call the Valyria principle.
Yeah,
based on a character who was in the first Conan the Barbarian movie, which was Conan the Barbarian,
right?
And that movie is, of course, this sort of, it's epic fantasy, clearly. The whole movie is, but there was this element in it between Valyrian and Conan, which was a romance element.
Yes.
You know, they met and they were these two people who were kind of alike and they fell in love and then she died and he was upset about it.
Right.
And then she, she came back in a, typical fantasy way. She came back to help him out during a battle. There was a coherent romance in this fantasy movie. So the question that I would pose to people who are kind of might be resistant to us being so critical about these stories being included in sci-fi and fantasy categories is, imagine you're a romance fan and someone put Conan the Barbarian up for an award for the best romance film of whatever.
Right.
And then imagine it won.
Right.
Wouldn't you feel like you had a right to be a little upset about this?
I'm not sure that I would be angry.
Mostly, but you're not a romance fan.
That's true.
Right.
I'm not a romance fan, but like that's a good love story.
I do agree it's a good love story, but I don't believe that it makes Conan the Barbarian a romance.
A romance lead.
It's
right.
not a romance story.
Right.
Just because
Fabio at one point was considered for the
now,
role.
Now, on the other hand, the first three movies in the Pirates of the Caribbean that's debatable whether that's a romance story and a fantasy adventure.
Right.
Because the romance is central to the story. Whereas in Conan the Barbarian, it's window dressing. You can imagine that movie without that element in it, and it would still be the same movie.
Yes.
I liked the romance in that movie, so I wouldn't want that to be taken out, but you could totally take it out and still have Conan the Barbarian recognized.
And now keep in mind, I'm gonna comment on something else, but I also want to tell people out there who are watching and who are going to listen to this podcast, like, don't take the standards that we apply to stories in science fiction as an attempt to shut down the conversation. If you're unhappy with something that we say, feel free to email.
To say that the stories are bad.
Or just, if you don't agree with what we're saying, we're open to your feedback.
Yeah.
You want to feedback and say, no, I think you're being unfair, or no, I think that you suck.
We're being overly strict.
Whatever, you can say that. We're interested in having a discussion with people who are following us and listening to us. We're not interested in shutting it down.
Right.
Now, the other thing that I will say is, I believe in something that I call rigorous science fiction. I am not a scientist, but when I write a story, I do a ton of research.
Right.
That's rigorous science fiction, and I feel like we're kind of getting away from that, in that the reason why fantasy stories have become so popular, and there's nothing wrong with them, because like I said, a lot of them are great stories, but one of the reasons why the feel is so full of them is because people are getting away from rigorous science, from the process of rigorous research. I loved William Gibson when I was a kid, and the reason why is because, and if you read his article and his interview in Across the Winter Galaxies, he talks about how he is a stack of popular mechanics. And how he would read about engineering principles and scientific principles and where technology was going in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And even though some of that stuff never really came to fruition, I really admired that, and I modeled myself after that. And I feel like, that there are a lot of things that are being ignored or dismissed because they contain that level of rigorous research.
Right.
Like, it's boring because they're science fiction, or we have to make it more accessible, which is fine, but why not encourage people?
And that's what I feel like has happened.
Yes.
Is that in an effort to make science fiction more accessible, and fantasy to a certain degree, they're starting to... They allowed things to be categorized as science fiction and fantasy that aren't...
Right.
As a sort of, I mean, almost,
well, even like, even the conflation of science fiction and fantasy in and of itself.
Yeah, well, that's a ridiculous conflation. It's not, the fact that we're talking about a set of awards that throws them all in the same category is itself problematic.
Yes,
because they're not.
I honestly think that they should consider making a science fiction award and a fantasy award.
I agree. I absolutely agree, because they're not the same kind of story, and they rely on completely different methods of. STEM is what you're studying to write a good science fiction story.
Right.
The humanities is what you're studying to write a good history.
Right.
Mythology and all that stuff is what you're maybe some sociology and linguistics, but it's two completely separate genres based on two completely separate.
Art by Veda says it's dumbed down. I agree with that.
Yeah, it's dumbed down. It's dumbed.
Well, the other thing that I think is going on also is I'm seeing a lot, because there are a lot. The ecosystem, as we know, starts in the workshops.
Right.
And what's going on right now is that I don't know if it's the instructors who are guiding the writers to this, or if it's the writers themselves who. One of the things I've seen is I'll see a story that I like, and I'm like, well, I'm not sure how sciencey it is, but it's a good fantasy story. I'm going to follow this person's career, and then the next thing that they produce is like a young adult novel.
Right.
And what that says to me is that they are clearly weren't really that interested in being a science fiction or fantasy writer.
That was the way they got in the door. It's a kind of a bait and switch, a little bit.
It's a little bit of a bait and switch. And
you pad your resume.
Yes, like I've written other stuff that's been published that's not science fiction or fantasy at all, and in fact, it's very factual. But I don't add that to my when I'm submitting. I don't put that in my cover letter because to me it's not relevant.
Right.
So and I don't begrudge that person. I still am a fan of that person's writing and what they've done, but I'm seeing a lot of it.
Well, and another thing about that, which got me about a lot of these stories, which, as we said, I liked a lot of these stories, even the ones that I disqualified because they don't, the Frankenstein principle, the Valyria principle, they fail on those, the basic genre categorization principles. And what bothers me about it is that if you're a good writer and you can write a good story, then your writing should be honored in the place that it belongs, not somewhere else. And if writers actually feel like the only way that they can get published is if they abs phone home their story, which that's another principle, which is
we spoke about that last
we talked about it. We just where you just add these trappings. You add a little magic, or you add a little science fiction something.
Well, recap. What's Abbess Von Holm?
Okay, Abbess Von Holm is from this this list that was, I think, created at a literary convention called the Turkey City Lexicon of various literary pitfalls. As a matter of fact, I'll just quote the lexicon, because I have the quote here. Abbess Von Holm takes its name from a mainstream story. I don't like the term mainstream. It was a historical fiction story about a medieval cloister which was sold as science fiction because of the serendipitous arrival of a UFO at the end. And by extension, any mainstream story with gratuitous SF or fantasy element tacked on so it could be sold. And that's the part that bothers me, is that nobody, if any of the writers that I'm going to disqualify because their stories are not fantasy or sci-fi really,
yes,
felt that they had to do this because otherwise they couldn't get published, that's unfair, and that needs to be addressed on its own besides the
fact that it does a disservice to the people who are doing the rigorous work.
Yeah, and it does, yeah, it insults everybody in the process.
Yes.
By the way, that novella that is at the Abbess Von Holm, it is called Souls by Joanna Russ, and it was published in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
In 1982. In
1982, yeah. And it was Nebula nominated, and it actually won the Hugo and the Locus.
Yes. And then one of the other
so
things...
So this problem has been going on for a long time.
It has been going on for a while. And one of the things I'm seeing now, too, is I'm seeing a lot of recycled stories. I'm seeing a lot of stories
we that saw were, a couple that, of things here that were just like, wow, I've read this 1,000 times.
Well, I mean, I don't even mean like the storylines. I mean, like when I'm reading some online publications, they're like originally published in the 2011. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, are we that hard up for stories that we're republishing stuff from 7 or 8 years ago?
I think that what it is...
I've been rejected a lot, and I think I'm an okay writer.
Right, but I think that what it is, a lot of what it is that there, it's not that there aren't enough writers, but that so many writers are just, to hell with it, I'm self-publishing.
Yes, that's true.
I'm going on Patreon.
But you know what, self-publishing, like one of my friends was telling me how he, for Christmas, he got Kindle Unlimited. And so what that did was it incentivized him to read a bunch of garbage that he wouldn't otherwise. So there was a lot of stuff in there that was like, dude, you've got like 50 typos in the first paragraph.
Right, right.
But then he said there were a couple of gems that he was like, I'm straight up going to keep reading the series.
Right.
Now, what that should, I think, should incentivize the editors to go, hey, look, like, you know what? $7.95 Kindle Unlimited, I can find the next.
They should pick that guy up.
Right. Let's pick him up. Let's get a piece of short fiction that we can buy from him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the publications these days, they pay fairly well.
Right.
And I can't imagine that, like, and I don't know about you, I've got like a stack of stuff.
Yeah, I've got a lot of stuff. Like, I've got a huge, you know, backlog of things that, you know, might need a final, one final edit.
Right.
And, you know.
So what I'm pointing to at this point is I'm seeing kind of, when you look at like the beef cattle industry and how they don't free graze them anymore because they feed them corn.
Right.
That's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing the sort of breakdown.
That's a good, and we need to go back to this, to that model, which is like what a lot of people are saying about all of our, you know, we started to put all the chickens into this gigantic cage together.
Now it's free
range. And now it's terrible. And so we, you know, there, maybe we need to go free range literature.
Yes.
We need to go back to free range literature.
Free range. I like that. Free range. You heard it here first, folks. Free range literature.
Yeah.
So what they're doing right now is they're fracking the genre.
They're fracking the genre.
Right.
And we need to go back to a more ecological and, you know, a green model of literature that doesn't industrialize it through these work. Not that there's anything wrong with workshops, but you have to recognize that they have negative, they have side effects that you have to mitigate to keep it from doing things like pushing people to write stuff that they really don't need to.
I don't know, because I haven't been to one of those workshops. I mean, I went to one at UVA years and years ago, but I don't know how much. When I went to UVA, I had like free range.
Right.
So I don't know how much, you know, they're influenced by the instructors.
Right.
All I can say is that there are a lot of stories that are coming out that are not.
And that's where I mainly know, is like people who come out of MFA programs. And there was the one writer, we were talking about him recently, who came out of an MFA program, and he wrote a really scathing review of what the programs do.
Mm-hmm.
And by, you know, this sort of homogenization, which is bizarre because diversity is part of their, you know, it's part of their buzzword set, and yet what they end up homogenizing everything and making everything sound alike.
It's like weird democratization through homogenization.
Yeah, it is a strange thing. Oh gosh, the guy's name starts with a K. He's the author.
Oh, Rahul.
Yeah, Rahul Kanakia.
Yeah, yeah. Rahul Kanakia.
Yeah, I think that's how you pronounce his name. Yeah. I may be wrong.
Just, and oddly, I think he went on to write for Disney or something. Which was
I don't
like,
know. But he was part, when I first bumped into him, he was specifically part of an anthology that was all about diversity.
Yeah.
And then he posted a blog post that was talking about, well, MFA programs also sort of water everything down, and he was complaining about that. But he did say he wasn't blasting them because he had some good things to say. But he said we also have to watch out, which is kind of what we're saying. We're not tearing apart this process of workshops and MFAs.
Right.
What we're saying is anything you do to change a complex system is going to have negative side effects.
Yes,
and you have to mitigate.
And it may just be an autopilot.
Side effects.
It may just be Rahul. I think he went on to write like. For like a Disney show or a kid show, he got picked up by Disney or something like that. But I remember reading his story about a fly.
Well, and was it was a fly like, or was it a cricket?
I thought it was a fly. But it was like so science fiction.
It was a little insect, and it had all the memory that right. all of it. And it was yeah,
it was like the story. It was like the most, like he clearly was somebody either who was just multi talented. Or he was like straight up science fiction.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
not only was that story really science fiction, but it was kind of Disney-y.
It was.
Yeah,
I
can definitely see that being
great story.
A
you're
CGI
out there,
oh, story,
what's
yeah.
up, dude?
Yeah.
So we can get to the stories. You want to start with the novelettes or the best stories?
Yeah, let's get through the novelettes and we'll just go through before we do the reveal about which one we chose.
Okay.
Although it may the narrowing down from what ones I consider to just be disqualified. If I were running, I wouldn't have allowed them in there. So the first one is Dirty Old Town,
yeah,
by Richard Bowes,
yeah.
which is, you know...
First appeared in the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction
in
May of last year.
Right. And this is one of my disqualifiers, because the magic in this, the ability to read each other's minds, is so peripheral to the story
mm-hmm.
and so unnecessary to what happened. The story is basically this semi-autobiographical story about a guy growing up
in
South
Boston.
Boston.
Yeah. Before you get into that, real quick, this is from a list published originally by The Verge of where you can read the nominees for free.
Right.
And we're gonna repost that article.
Right. So you can read these two, and you can read this and tell me that I'm an idiot for thinking that this wasn't.
We're open to being called idiots. Happens to us every day.
Right. Mostly when I'm looking in the mirror. So.
you idiot.
So it is, yeah, it was a decent story, basically a sort of, like I was telling you earlier, it sounded very much like an NPR podcast.
Yes.
And not my favorite type. It would probably not be something I would choose to listen to. It wasn't a bad story, but the fantasy was just stapled on.
Yes.
As if to get it through the door into...
And it verged on magical realism.
It did. But
it was like not magical realism because there wasn't enough of it in there.
Right.
So, do we want to talk about what it was? I mean, so the character had this ability to actually, he talked about how magical his grandparents were from the old country.
Right.
One, and his grandmother taught him this invocation that would actually put him into the minds of other people.
Of other people, right.
And that was interesting, but it was more like a Frank McCourt novel.
Which this writer is, he's a good writer.
Yeah.
And he's good enough to where he wouldn't have had to do magic to get into someone else's head. The character could have just been insightful, and it was just like there's no reason for the fantasy element to be here. You could literally with 15 minutes of editing take the fantasy out of this story, out of this novelette length writing, and have this exact same story, but you just have to publish it somewhere else, which is where it should have been published. And that's the thing that's
I personally think that this story could have been published anywhere.
It could have been in any mainstream.
I mean, that's how well written it was. It was like barely fantasy.
Barely fantasy.
Yes.
Barely fantasy. And like I said, if it's gotten to the point in where what people call literary fiction, or what I would prefer to call modern realist fiction, is so hard to get into that people are just putting fantasy in science, then that's bad, and that needs to be addressed. It's not that we need to teach writers, we need to start teaching readers to read stories like that without having something flashy in it.
Yes.
This was a decent story.
Yes.
I disqualified it on the grounds that it fails the Frankenstein principle.
The Frankenstein principle. Do we want to move on to Weaponized Math?
Weaponized Math. By the way, here's the bio stuff I've dug up on this guy, and you may have known this. He's a retired Marine colonel.
Yep.
Who is now the director of international business for a textile firm that manufactures in Thailand. So, I also looked up something else we had talked about.
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to do a brief description of what the story
is? The story is about it's military science fiction.
Yes.
And the story...
Which we both generally like.
Yes, we both generally like. And this is a it follows a sniper on a distant alien planet. But there's a conflict there, and she and this the sniper and her marine squad have been deployed to protect this the arrival of this field grade officer.
Right.
And, you know, and sure enough, you know, rebels attack, and this sniper and her group have to end up defending themselves. And
rebels gonna rebel.
Yeah, rebels gonna rebel. And so that was the basic story premise.
Right.
I was not crazy about the story.
I was not either.
I have to say that the story tried too hard in the beginning.
Right.
It was front-loaded with a lot of jargon.
Yes.
And military SF is gonna do that.
Right.
Except that you have to rely more on sort of spaced exposition for that to happen.
Right.
If you front-load everything, it's like you're giving an operations order.
You exactly. Know what I mean? It's like... A lot of it read very much like as if they had cut and pasted from these people's...
It read to me like an after action report.
Three paragraph orders. Huh?
Like an after action report.
Right.
Literally, like, it was just like.
And the weird thing is this guy's a retired Marine Corps colonel who's had decades in. He doesn't have to prove himself. That's right. What the strange thing about this thing. Once I got his bio, I was like, because it read more like, and I told you this, it read more like some guy who's a junior enlistee who's only been in a year and a half.
Yep.
But he was obsessed with Soldier of Fortune magazine before he signed up. That's what it reads more like. It's like someone who feels like they have something to prove.
Yeah.
And then when I found out this guy is actually a retired Marine colonel,
I was surprised.
Dude, you don't have to prove to us that you know how the military works.
Right. You're a Marine, you know, like.
And so, yeah, exactly. You're a Marine. You better than, you know.
And we talk about this also, but there were all these moving parts in the story that didn't really, I won't say didn't need to be there, but they were either underexplained or didn't need to be there. And
one of them was the fact that they were on another planet.
Yes, the fact that they're on another planet. Like, I was like, why? Because we don't. This story was not long enough for there to be any exposition about the planet. I wouldn't know about the planet. I wouldn't know who the rebels were and why they were rebelling. I wouldn't know. I mean, like, I think they were human. I guess they were human. They were human. They were human rebels.
But it wouldn't have mattered if they weren't, because it never figured into the story.
Right, it never figured
into the story. This story could have been set anywhere. This story could have been set in Thailand.
It could have been set in Afghanistan in the distant future.
Exactly, and there was just... I, the whole time I kept waiting for something to happen that justified the science fiction in this, that made it central to the story, and at the end I was like, nope.
Yeah.
You could totally write all that stuff out and have the same exact story in anywhere.
Yes, and it would be like... It, you know, and we, you were going to mention the movie Shooter.
Yeah, let me get you the two quotes, because we noticed a quote from the story, and this is from Weaponized Math, which, by the way, is an awesome title.
It's a good title.
I like that title. And it's the main character, Staff Sergeant Gracie Medicine Crow, and here's her quote. It wasn't as if range was the only parameter that went into making a good shot. Her angle to the ground, the temperature, wind speed and direction, humidity, the planet's rotation, gravity, those and more would affect her round's trajectory. And you notice that this sounded kind of like...
Shooter.
Shooter with Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg.
Well, let me get you his quote for comparison. You know what it takes to make a shot at that range? Everything comes into play that far. Humidity, elevation, temperature, winds, spin drift, even the Coriolis effect, the spin of the Earth comes into play. No way, he didn't know. That's not
so. You think that you
cut and pasted, but holy moly,
it's close.
It's so close. I mean, here, what do you got? How to temperature, wind speed, winds, direction. Well, yeah, humidity, the planet's rotation. Yes, the rotation of the spin of the Earth. It's just all this. It's too
convenient. Too close.
It's a little too convenient. And here's. The only thing, what I hope happened here was that this list is common. I'm not in the sniper community. I did really well on my test. I got my expert marksman ribbon, but I wasn't in the sniper community. I'm kind of hoping that this list, in both cases, are echoing something that's commonly said in the sniper community rather than weaponized math. Echoing Shooter.
Yes.
Because that would be really disappointing to me.
Well, I will say, and this is neither a defense nor whatever. He's a Marine Corps colonel.
Yep.
We also know that Marines are riflemen.
Yep.
Constant riflemen.
Absolutely.
We know that Mark Wahlberg's character in the movie Shooter, also a Marine.
Right.
Marine sniper.
So that's why.
Right.
So I hope it's that. I hope it's that. Both of those stories are echoing the sniper community. Something that's commonly said in the sniper community, right. Rather than weaponized math echoing Shooter, because that would just be
Dan DeLuca just logged in.
Hello, hey, Dan.
So I hope that's the case also. So what I would say is,
but on grounds, like I said, as far as military science fiction, I mean, if you're the kind of person who likes military science fiction, it's a little, like you said, it tries a little too hard.
Yeah.
But I also, as far as I go, for my picks, I disqualify it as science fiction because there's no reason for the science fiction to be in this story.
Yes, agreed.
It could be just as good as it is if it were set anywhere else in the world, if it were set in Central America,
yep.
If it were set in Central Asia, if it were set anywhere, it would be just as good.
And I will say, too, even some really small tweaks of the story could have made science fiction-y. And the reason why that is, you know, in this quote that you talk about is Spindrift, Coriolis effect, blah, 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 is he could have taken those things and turned them on their head, and it would have been a science fiction story.
Yep.
He could have said, you know what, you know, I'm using the 3331, you know, the 331 Lapua, and by the way, the magnetic north on this planet is, so I had to use rare earth magnet, you know, round, and, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it could have been something that messed with her scope, messed with the round.
Right.
The humidity was too high.
Like, you can't take something designed to shoot on Earth and use it there because the planet has a different magnet. Yes.
Yes. There's so many things that he could have just turned his head like that. And I would have been like, that's convincing.
That would have been science fiction.
Yes.
If the locals had been aliens.
See how easy it is, people of science?
Yeah. If the locals had been an alien species.
Yeah, right.
And they had, and that had affected, we have to, you know, they're much better shooters at this kind of range than we are. And we have
absolutely.
To, that would have made it science fiction. But as it was just sort of stapled on after the fact. And you know, I'm thinking, and I totally believe this, is that if this were not a science fiction, if this were not pitched as a science fiction story, I wouldn't know where that story, if it were, you know.
Yes.
I don't know where that story would have been published.
I definitely would, I wasn't super, and I'll say this, and we can move on to the next story, is I wasn't crazy about the writing.
Too crazy about the writing either. It was, like, beyond the fact that it was just too jargon heavy, which is a weird thing to say about military fiction.
True.
It tends to be. But it was...
The prose wasn't great.
The basic plot... I don't want to spoil the story, because I would like people to read the story and make their own mind.
Yeah, make their own mind. It's a surprising nomination.
Yeah, but the end of the story... How the story ended, I mean, you sort of almost figure out what's going to happen, knowing the sort of gung-ho camaraderie that goes on in military fiction. You almost figure out what the ending's going to be.
Yeah.
You go, oh, okay, I know what's going to happen. She's going to do this for that guy.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So, but, again, read the story on your own, but those are two novelettes that I personally consider disqualified.
Yeah.
So we gotta even though they weren't bad stories, they were just not, the first one was not really fantasy, and the second one was not really science fiction.
Yeah.
So
next one, Wind Will Rove.
The next one. Yeah, this was another one that came off to me like an NPR podcast. I actually like this story a lot. I mean, the thing is, the author is a Baltimore singer-songwriter, and I'm a singer-songwriter, so you know, this is probably why I like the story, because the story was about
this. I thought it would appeal to you.
Yeah.
And not just because of the singing-songwriting, but the linguistic aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And the idea of how things change over time is always something that's, you know, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
But the concept is that this is a generation ship, which, if you don't know what that is, that's a ship that moves so slow that multiple generations of people are going to be on it before it reaches the star that
right.
it gets to.
Right.
And so at some point in the past, the saboteur erased all of their cultural files, so now they're forced to recreate a lot of these things, even recreate movies and plays and songs from memory. And so the main characters in the story are involved in recreating songs.
Yeah.
And so they go through this, and specifically is this song, which has multiple titles, but the one that ends up in the title of this novelette is Wind Will Rove.
Right.
Okay. Now this is going to sound weird, because I know the setup the synopsis that I just gave for this story sounds like there's no way that the science could be taken out of it.
Right.
But I found the science so distracting in this that I were just like, I just want this to be set in some small town in northern New York, mm-hmm. in upstate New York, where there are just some people who are trying to gather up old songs, and the kids who don't understand it are just... that don't understand it for the reason that kids already don't understand it. You don't need this. You don't need the generation ship around it.
But I still like that element.
I knew we were going to disagree on whether this qualifies as science fiction.
Well, here's the thing, because that one element where she talks about how the children don't even understand what certain things are. For example, animal husbandry.
But that's true today in our world.
That is true. That's true. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
But there were a few things that she talked about in reference to that.
Right.
Like, oh, they don't even know they don't even know what it is to be outside. And I agree, the element, the reinsertion of the science fiction element at these regular intervals could be a little bit distracting.
It was very distracting.
But I honestly have to say I liked Sarah Pinkster. I liked the story.
Okay.
I liked the construction of it. I agonized over it. I got to tell you.
Yeah,
I agonized over it because the story is beautiful.
It is a beautiful story, and I'll be honest. If I didn't disqualify it, and it's weird that I'm being more stickler about science fiction than you are on this. If I didn't disqualify it, this would have been my winner.
Well, part of it
it's my favorite of these novelettes.
Here's the thing: she does an end around the criteria. Because it's not just the backdrop, right? The whole story is encompassed. It's rolled up into shit.
See, that's the thing.
There's an element that you can't get. So you felt like she cheated.
I not cheated, but I felt like, you know how it is when someone grabs your arm, you might not have been thinking about going anywhere, but now that's all you want to do.
Yes.
The fact that I felt like the whole story was sort of trapped in that, I was just made me want even more for the main story, which was a very good story about how generations don't understand each other,
yes.
and how we're losing so much, and we're losing so much of our cultural heritage, even though we haven't experienced a blackout.
Science fiction is a cultural heritage.
We are losing so much because, does it really matter that a lot of these songs are stored on a computer somewhere if nobody ever listens to them?
True.
So that's that part of it. I felt like,
I'm not a terribly,
I loved it.
I'm not the least sentimental person.
I'm not. I'm super.
I will murder you for a lollipop, right? But like,
I have lollipops over there if you want one. So I'm good.
But I still liked it. I feel like the way she did it was clever.
You thought that the way that she fit it into the generator, that was a clever.
I felt like, when you don't have the requisite technical knowledge to do it, she did it in a way that gave it. In other words, I felt she recognized that. And she took steps to remedy it. You know what I mean?
And she never overstepped. I mean, it never seemed to me that the science in it was implausible. It just seemed to me that it was unnecessary to tell the basic story about generational misunderstandings.
But you can still tell those stories using a science fiction vehicle, as long as it's not like, it's so gratuitous. In other words, I feel like she was mindful of that. Do you know what I mean?
She didn't just, you're right that she didn't just inject things here and there.
Right.
But to me, it still qualifies as window dressing because I could have taken it away.
Sure.
And I still would have loved, it would have been still the same
point
story,
wasn't the
and
science,
I would have loved. Right. Yes,
and
exactly.
And the server, their servers being erased, like that's, it was like, it was convenient.
But see, that's the thing. The servers being erased that's the one thing that really got me, was because the servers being erased and the blackout, which was so central to what was going on in the story, that itself wasn't necessary because kids today already.
Yeah.
Don't have these things. We're already losing things. We have all these things, and this has been going on for so long. You know, like the Smithsonian Museum has all these. You know, where they back in the 1800s were trying to record people because we were losing things.
Yeah.
And like Sea Lion Woman came out of that. They just went down and there was these girls singing a song and they just recorded them. And if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have that song.
True.
Which is an amazing song that has been redone.
And she probably
knows
that.
Right. But we didn't need to be on a spaceship with a blackout for
I
that
agree.
To happen, and
I
that's
agree.
Where I go. And that's what got me about that is like the, to me, that story is so important and so good that it doesn't need the extra stuff to get by.
I'm going to go with, I like the story because I like the story.
Okay, I love the story. It's my favorite of the novelettes.
I can't really say anything other than, you're right, it didn't need to be on a spaceship. You could have stripped the scientific elements out of it and it would still have been a great story.
Yeah, it's not Frankenstein.
It's not, it doesn't meet the Frankenstein principle.
No.
But I feel like, like I said, she knows that, and she was mindful of it. So she gets points from it.
Yeah, she didn't. It didn't come off And I'm not going to say, you know, in a lot of stories like this, you feel like the person's cheating.
Yes.
Like they know damn well they don't have a...
Right.
And they just go, yeah, but I put a little thing in there.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no, this character's brother is an alien, so that counts. I'm like, yes. It didn't have to be an alien. No, you're right. She's not disrespectful.
Right.
About it. But I just felt like... I liked the story so much that I didn't feel like it needed... It did need that to get into Asimov's.
Right.
Which is where it was published. Which is kind of a sad comment in itself.
Yes.
I really hope that that's not why the story is set in outer space instead of just, like I said, upstate New York or something.
Or we're never going to get through this if we don't.
Okay, well, I love that story. That was my favorite novelette, but I disqualified it on principle grounds. The next novelette was A Series of Stakes by Vinaj Hemant Prasad, which was published in Clark's World.
Singaporean writer.
Yeah, she's a Singaporean writer, and she, in her bio, says that she's working against the world machine, I guess, by trying to become part of it, because that's what this is, part of the world machine, that you're, you know, Clark's World is a company, it's, you know, it's an enterprise, but whatever.
Clark does some, he did a lot of really edgy stuff.
Well,
was from Clark's World.
In this particular story, which is about someone who,
who
3D prints counterfeit steaks.
Yes.
For steakhouses. Which is an intriguing story. It's fantastic. She drops a lot of pop culture fluff in there, and like what name dropping what I assume are imaginary East Asian pop bands.
Yes.
And I'm like, that's part of the entertainment industry. That's the world machine.
Possibly.
That's,
did you research?
I did not check whether they were. And to me, it really doesn't matter.
True.
Because that was the one thing that just that to me was the down part of that story, because it was just seemed like there was so much signaling to establish the author's coolness. And I'm like, you don't need to do this. The story is good enough. This story is really good.
Yeah.
You don't need to start. You don't need to make it cool, and
I agree with that, and I tend to filter a lot of that out. But I do. Number one, I feel like the premise was original.
It was very original. Yeah.
I think that she took something that's happening today, which is like 3D printing, the confluence of that and cloned meat.
Right. Is something else we're talking about.
Today. Right. Something else we're talking
Huge.
About.
Huge.
And she took those two things, put them together, and she built a story out. I was like,
with the crime element built in there, that she's doing it to forge steaks,
so
that people can cheat their customers at steakhouses.
Right,
that was to me genius.
Genius.
I love that.
Absolutely genius.
That's the first one that I thought qualified as science fiction, because you can't take that out of it.
Strong technical knowledge. She went into the character's background and how she got into it. I thought that was great. I think the introduction of the second character and the crime element added crime element was awesome.
Right.
I'm going to tear through this because the thing that I did not like about this, let me see, what's the name of the story? The story is called, from Rod Kresge, it's called A Series of Stakes. And I'm not sure if you were on earlier, Rod, but we said that we're going to post a list of where you can read all of these stories for free.
Right.
And you can make your own determination about whether they're science fiction or not, or if you like them or not.
Well, all except Dirty Old Town, right?
All Dirty Old Town, we actually had to buy the fantasy and science fiction issue that it appeared in. So props to you, FSNF. F and SF. So the couple things I didn't like about the story was, number one, was the secondary character. I think it was Kelly. Is it Kelly?
I don't remember the
second character. Anyway, she... Like at one point this tough comes around and menace the main character, basically like a hitman, and the secondary character, you know, basically comes back in the middle of the girl being sort of roughed up and kicks the guy. He beats the crap out of the guy.
Right.
And without explaining anything about this girl's background, other than it was kind of shady.
Right.
Or just the fact that she had a bunch of different jobs, it didn't explain like how she was kind of such a badass. And this guy's supposed to be like a hitman.
Yeah, he's supposed to be. Yeah, he's supposed to be a huge thug. And
they raise
this person right. And this girl just shows up, and uppercuts him once and knocks him out.
Yeah,
and with no explanation of why, you know, if she had revealed it, you know, after that, well, I used to be part of this paramilitary organization,
right.
I'd be like, okay,
or is it mandatory service, or I took martial arts class,
something.
I would've been like, yeah, okay,
but no, they raid her,
right?
Or you know, it was a Ray character, just unexplained badassery.
Yes,
and
I like to have the badass. You enhance the badassery through the explanation,
right? Oh yeah, you make it even better,
and you make it believable,
right?
You know what I mean, it's got nothing to do with her being a woman. It's got to do with the fact that she just mysteriously a badass.
Yeah, just it was mysteriously out of nowhere, and
that's why I say they raid her, because. Oops. Ray is like
Ray, yeah. Ray from Star Wars.
From Star Wars is like, so for some reason, just a total badass.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other thing I didn't like about it was the story ended rather abruptly. She kind of epilogued us, which I'm not a big fan of that.
So it did. I agree with that.
If you're Tolkien, you can epilogue, but if you're...
I didn't hate it as much as
you did. If it's a novelette,
you
can't epilogue.
I didn't like it very much.
You didn't like the story?
No, I love the story.
Right.
I thought that the ending was a little rushed, too, but I didn't react as badly as you did.
I felt like unsatisfied.
I would definitely like to see this story broaden into a full length novel. Yes. Because there's so much in it that's still
the other thing was it was very cyberpunk. That was the other thing I liked about this story. The thing is, I like these cyberpunk stories, but I like the slice of life cyberpunk stories.
Right.
In other words, it's not some kind of grand like Tessier Ashpool like. In the orbital substation, it doesn't have to be that. It's some girl, her daily life is she's a forager and it sucks and it's mundane and this is how she survives.
Right.
I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it too. So, not only did I like the story, but I also didn't disqualify it.
Yes. I did not disqualify. Next story, Human Stain.
The last one.
Second
to last one. A Human Stain, which if you didn't know this, it was also a famous Philip Roth novel. Which was made into a movie.
With Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, but that was The Human Stain. This is A Human Stain. I couldn't detect in this story any attempt to comment on that connection between those titles at all.
I didn't think it was quasi-parody, but you know what? It wasn't science fiction.
I don't think it has anything to do with it.
It wasn't science fiction either.
Or fantasy.
It was basically supernatural thriller or horror. But not science
fiction. Kind of, but it was all kind of thrown on at the end.
It was all through Abbas Phone Home. That was an Abbas Phone Home.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there were foreshadowings of it.
Yes,
there were foreshadowings
true.
Of it.
There
was
some foreshadowing.
It was the big reveal at the end that made it. I didn't disqualify this, by the way. I thought it was... It was just enough.
There was too much information about her life in Paris and what kind of cigarette she smoked and the fact that she was drinking... I was like, who cares? I want to know what's going on beneath that. Right.
Plus, I didn't feel like, and I hate to say this because here's the bio of this person. She sounds like a great person. she grew up in the foothills of the Canadian Rockies, competed in rodeos and
awesome.
What is that word? Is that Gymkhana's? I don't know.
I'm not going
to
comment.
Whatever that is, that I don't know what that is. I have to look that up now because that's interesting. It looks like it's part. See, that part looks Greek, and that part looks. Looks like it's either Arabic or Urdu. Anyway, Crown Princess of the Hilton Bighorn Rodeo. Hi, you can't beat that.
It's a well-written story.
It is a well-written story.
It's a very well-written story.
Well, to me, it was so weird.
It was quasi-Lovecraftian, but it just didn't... It didn't... Anyway, it was more like horror to me. And I was hoping... I wouldn't mind seeing...
I wanted more out of the main character, too. I just wanted more... I didn't really get a sense... I got the same sense of personalization or like development in the main character that I would expect from a background character.
Yes.
Even though she was a lot in the story about what she was doing and what she was thinking, what she was feeling, but it never cohered to me for me into a person for some reason.
Yeah.
And I don't understand.
And there were parts that were genius about how she could taste the salt in her tongue.
Right.
And how it made her think of pork and like she wanted to eat pork and how she wanted I dug that part and I was like, man, this person's really hitting that point.
Right.
But there's so much detracting from it up to that point.
Yeah. And you don't
it
just occurred to me what this reminds me. The main character and all the cool... Because especially when you said about the taste of the song. Have you seen the movie Perfume?
No.
Oh. Okay, it's about this guy who has a weird sense of smell.
Right.
Like he can detect smell really better than everybody else.
Yeah.
And of course, that puts him into the sort of Tim Burton, you're a weirdo and everybody hates you category. But he becomes really good at making perfume. Well, the problem is that he's obsessed with... the smell of women, and he keeps killing women and putting them in the perfume, right? So you think, a really interesting character.
Yeah.
And here's the weird thing. Well acted by the guy, but still, at the end of the movie, you don't really have a sense of who he is as a person.
Right.
He's just this vessel to be... And that's the same sense I got here, is that... and I like the movie Perfume. I thought it was a really fantastic movie. I like this story, but
If it were a little longer and if it were a little bit more satisfying, I would say Bram Stoker. Hands down, Bram Stoker. Nebula, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, So I can't
say. Last story in the novelette category
right.
is Small Changes Over Long Periods of Time.
Right, by Kellen Sparrow.
Yes.
I'm assuming that's how it may be Shbara. I don't know what language that
Shbara.
Is.
Shbara. Yeah.
This guy, what did we get there?
Well, we got a pre-op transgender vampire.
Yeah.
Some person who gets
female to male.
Female to male. Yes, female to male, right. Being changed into a vampire, getting bitten by somebody while they're
right.
While now, peeing in the alleyway. And
it just is, and this is the thing. You know my stories.
Yes.
I do not shy away from having queer characters in my stories.
Check out John Nelson on Patreon. He has a story series called Zines on there.
Right, there's a whole entire species.
There's a whole species of people,
androgynous,
who are and
engineered human beings.
Right.
So this is you have to set that up, because whenever you start to critique something like this, people will immediately assume that you're just being transphobic or
right.
homophobic, and that's not at all what it is. It just seemed like, well, first of all, the I'm turning into a vampire story has been so overdone.
Yes.
It's just that transformation is fascinating. But it's been done so many times.
Yes.
And so that's what this story is. Just that draped over the transgender experience story.
Yes.
And I felt having these two things together,
yeah.
Like Anne, we were talking about Anne Rice.
Yeah.
But she does it so
yes.
it's so well, you don't feel cheated.
Right.
And this story I just felt cheated. I just felt like someone had, a really badly put together sandwich that they put a fancy napkin over.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, but there's not really...
And the funny thing
neither of these stories are satisfying.
The potential was there.
I think the potential was there.
But the convergence between those two things,
just,
vampirism and transsexuality?
Yeah.
Is...
Well, transgenderism.
Transgenderism was not... The convergence was too crude. It was like slamming together at really high speed,
right.
And then whatever happened. And
the vampire part, the vampire aspect of the story really read kind of fan fiction.
It was, yes, it was. And the funny thing is that the trans portions, the parts where that this person was explaining the life of a trans person, that was very compelling.
It was
just the vampire part kind of mucked it up a bit.
And the sort of interplay between the transgender part and the fact that there were other non-transgender gay characters, and the way that sort of the dynamic there, I found that was very fascinating to me.
Yes.
It just wasn't... It would have been more fascinating to me if someone had written a blog about this is what happened to me and how weird this was that these things interacted, but this didn't seem like there's not a story. There's first of all, there is this turning into a vampire thing, which is like, you know, it's the story that's been a billion things
yeah.
about this, and you have to make something more about.
Well, the thing that made the story compelling was more interesting than the story itself.
Right.
In other words,
but
the vampire part was not interesting at all.
It was not only what's compelling about the story, not only is it not fantasy, it's not even fiction.
Right.
It would have been way more compelling if it had just been told as...
Not a vampire story.
Not a vampire story, and this is what really happens to people.
Yes.
And I suspect... I suspect that the writer has taken these stories. I mean, I don't want to accuse, but like writers often do, you know, your friends tell you anecdotes, you're like, oh, that's my character's doing that.
Right.
So that a lot of these things the part that we really liked about the thing, which was the diving into that, the dynamics and of sexuality and gender and that, were actual anecdotes that
yeah.
were from real people that he knows, and. I would have rather have heard that as a long essay
yes.
than this as a fiction story.
So tell me, who is your pick for best novelette? Who do you think is going to win?
Series is... Oh, who do I think is going to win? Who
yeah.
I think should win?
Well...
Okay, who do I think is going to win?
Who do you think should win?
I think that a series of stakes should win.
We both think that. I
yeah.
think Series of Stakes should win.
Yeah.
So we agree on the pick.
I have a suspicion that Wind Will Rove will win.
It wouldn't surprise me, because it was very richly written.
And like I said, it was, even though I thought Series of Stakes was the best among the ones that qualified, Wind Will Rove, I think, was my favorite overall.
Okay, so we
if this had been a general literary category,
yeah.
that would have been my favorite.
I would, we both agree on both of those.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a like rapid fire. Okay. Short stories. We've got like 10 minutes left.
Okay. Okay.
Likes, dislikes. Give, you know, what, I'm going to come out and say, I'm going to pick Vina Gmin the second time.
For she had a short story also. Right. Her short story was Fandom for Robots, which was where this sentient robot helps a human who doesn't really know that it's a robot over online write stories, write fan fiction, obviously, about robots. About this
show.
A show that has a robot in it.
Right.
And I thought it was a funny story.
That's what I liked about it is
okay.
It showed some range.
Yep.
It was science fiction. It was near future, even though it was like retro near future.
Right.
And the way that it was written, it was original. I gave it to her.
And the fact that the robot was a robot from the 50s kind of struck me as a sort of nostalgia. Like, she kind of knows where science fiction has come from. She, matter of fact, she makes it very clear that she understands how the old parts of science fiction. And she probably, you guys could probably have a really good conversation.
Yes.
So that was your pick?
That was my pick. I'm going to go down the line and say the authentic Indian experience, I knew where the story was coming from, but it was... they were talking about the technologies that they use to confer like certain experiences on people, you know,
VR type
experiences, and it just felt dated. It was a story about where we are right now,
right?
Even though that technology may or may not be in use for those reasons right now,
right?
I mean, working in that environment, I have not seen it. I've seen it for like, you know, African American experiences.
So the idea is that tourists will come up to this place and an American Indian sort of to get cliche stereotype stuff, and that's the whole point of the story is that all the characters who work there are themselves Native Americans.
Yes,
and I just felt like again there was no reason for the virtual reality science aspect of the story to be part of it, because I can imagine the exact same story happening if the tourists were going to just like a
but the thing is it does ranch it does something. That's the point. It does happen.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It does. Yeah, I mean, for it to be there.
And Rebecca Roanhorse. Yeah. I believe that's what she was trying to impart, is that this does indeed happen. But she took that story and she built it out into a futuristic setting. The problem is that it wasn't futuristic enough.
No. Well, that's a good point.
So if it was like, you know, I don't know. I can't speak to how it should have been. I could, but it would take me years. I just felt like the story fell short in terms of the technical aspect, or the futuristic aspect, or the scientific aspect. I mean, VR is. I mean, you know, we're neck deep in it right now.
Well, not only that, but the fact that, and I don't want to give away what this is allegorical for, but it's allegorical for something that's very obvious.
Yeah.
And the thing that it's allegorical for is something that we kind of know.
Yeah.
We don't really need to have, and so it made me kind of feel like that she's a good writer.
Yeah.
I liked the writing in the story. But I really hope that she writes something. I would like to have another story about these same people that wasn't an allegory for historical stuff.
Yes.
I mean, which is, you know.
I can see that. But that's one of the reasons why I say I feel like, and that's the one part that I will probably disagree with you on, is that I would like to see that story told, but I want to see some more effort put.
Can't be just that.
No, but that's my point. Yeah, that's my point is that science fiction is a vehicle for telling stories about tomorrow. Or even stories about today, tomorrow.
Right.
But her tomorrow was not tomorrow enough. It was too much today.
That is true. Right.
So I was like falling asleep. I was like, I want to hear this story, but I want something more engaging, interactive.
Right, right.
Anyway.
Okay. The third story was Utopia LOL.
Yeah.
Which was about a guy who wakes up into this sort of virtual reality utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Where this supercomputer is basically creating realities for human beings to play in, and this manic pixie dream girl is assigned to be his guide.
Yeah.
And she is a very silly, you know, manic pixie dream girl, and she's very silly, she's very frivolous, but apparently she is one of the most relatable human beings that exist, because the rest of them have gone off on these virtual reality rabbit holes until they become so weird that this person who's just recently brought out of cryogenics, because he had been put in there because he had cancer, which they cure immediately when he gets out.
Right.
I found this story was hilarious.
Yes.
I liked reading it, but it is the language was so today. Mm-hmm. Well, which was also one of those weird things, is it didn't sound like people in the future are going to sound like the way internet kids sound today.
Right.
But it sounds so much today that I worry that in 5 years it's going to sound ridiculous. It's like if you wrote a story. Are we off?
It's because we're an hour mark, so it cuts off after an hour. So, the Instagram cuts us off after an hour.
Okay, so we're still going, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but it would like to me if you wrote a story in 1967 and filled it with hippie talk.
Yes.
Hey man, love peace and rock and roll. In 5-10 years, it sounds ridiculous. Yeah. And so to me, I loved the story. I thought it was hilarious. I loved reading it. But it doesn't. I would never give it the Nebula because the legacy it sets.
Yes.
I don't want someone reading this in 15 years and going, what?
Yeah. And the thing I didn't like about it, and I agree with you, it was a funny story, is that it touched upon these kind of philosophical themes that's been overdone.
You know what I mean? A little bit, yeah.
Which is like, the you know, this person, you know, more human than human.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, okay.
Right.
All
right,
Tyrell Corporation. so
right,
but I did like the story. I enjoyed reading.
Oh, so there, I loved reading it. Yeah. So the next one is how much are we going to run over?
We're just at an hour. So okay. We have like, you know, we should probably.
We have the two more left.
Yes.
And one of them is the last novelist or A Dead Lizard in the Yard, which is about a guy.
No, we have three more. Clearly Lettered in the Most Steady Hand. Frank
Wong. Oh well, I have very little to say about that because I don't. I mean, to me, that was a surrealist story.
Yeah.
It wasn't fantasy.
Agreed.
Although some people might say, well, surrealism is part of fantasy, but I don't...
It was more of a genre being.
But yeah, in fantasy, you're expected to believe that this is real. And surrealism is more like a poem.
Yeah.
And that's this story. It was a good story as far as in that sort of story. I just don't think it belongs in the competition with these other stories like this. There are other really...
I'm content to move on to the last novelist.
Yeah. The last novelist for A Dead Lizard in the Yard is about a novelist who is dying, and has moved to this distant planet to finish his last novel, and then die. And he gets writer's block until he meets this girl, who's apparently a really good artist, and then that inspires him. She's so good at illustration.
Yeah.
That inspires him to write and. Of course, then you know things progress from there, and this story to me felt more like I'm way out of the picture on this one.
Yeah.
This story felt to me like more like classic sci-fi.
Yes.
And there was the typical a lot of projection of current things into the future, like you know the whole the difference between the two generations seemed to me more 2017 than whatever year this was.
Yeah.
But that's fine. That happens so much. It's just basically a part of science.
You
can't avoid it.
We need a trope for that.
But I love this story.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go ahead and say this is the one I would pick for best short story.
Okay.
I really like that a lot. And it's not just because I'm, you know, there's this thing about, well, I'm a writer, so I'm going to like a story about a writer.
No, but you're a writer too. So
yeah. The last one, Carnival Nine. This is the story about the little wind-up toys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And which was very... I liked the story, and I think I would love to see this story made into like a Pixar movie. But to me, it's the fact that the whole story was just an allegory for human life.
Yeah.
Which is where, to me, I'm like, come on, the story should be about itself.
Right.
It's not a parable.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, a story shouldn't be just... I feel like Tolkien talking to C.S. Lewis about don't just retell the Jesus story with a lion.
Right.
But I really feel that way.
Yes.
I feel like, you know, there's a difference between fiction and allegory because allegory is essentially nonfiction painted up.
Yes.
With elements, and that's what this was. It was a very moving allegory about human life.
Yeah.
But it still was an allegory.
It was an allegory, and... there was a fetishistic element, you know. Whenever I see things like wind-up dolls,
you
know, or porcelain dolls, or anything like that, I always see there's like a kind of fetishistic component to it, which kind of, I don't know if I just look at that and go, man, this person must be weird, or if it's just I have some kind of aversion to it,
right?
But but the thing is, I like the story also. It wasn't my pick.
No,
obviously, I mean, the Singaporean author. Vina Jeman Prasad, she was my pick.
Right.
So and you picked Matthew Kressel.
Yeah.
So we picked who we want to win. Is that? I think that Vinage and Prasad is the one who should win. Also, I mean, for me.
But who do you think will win? Knowing how these things go, I am going to. Wow.
I would say probably Kressel will win.
I almost don't want to say that because I don't want to make it sound like I'm right.
You're jinxing.
But it does.
You're jinxing us.
I do think that. No, I do think. Yeah, that's probably the one that they're going to pick too, simply because it's.
It's got everything.
It's got everything in it. It's like all the other ones. Like, there's some of these in here that are like I said, fun to read, but they kind of are frivolous a little bit. I mean, the Jamie Wall story, the Utopia story is.
I mean, Phantom of the Robots was frivolous, but it had it wasn't heavy-handed, and it was frivolous.
But no, it wasn't. Fun. But it also the thing that I think saved that from being really frivolous was that she was showing the legacy of the very. You know, the very genre that she was writing in, which that's impressive.
It was very meta.
Yeah, but there was a lot of it was very meta.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, inside it was meta too, because there was the character itself, what it was was doing was meta, and then the whole story was meta. So there was like three layers.
Well, and also the medium through which these two guys were communicating,
right,
was, you know, because you didn't know the guy on there was a robot,
right?
You know what I mean? So it was like,
right,
that was meta. You know what I mean? It was all, it was a good story. Yeah. So, Singaporean author, my pick. Your pick is Matthew Kressel. I think
for
Kressel.
This one, I picked her for the novelette, though.
I think Kressel will win. We both agree on the novelette.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. A series of stakes.
So we sorry we had a rush at the end, but you know we get tied up.
Yeah, we do.
Talking.
We ran our mouth too much at the beginning.
It's way too much in the beginning. But before we go, I am going to say remind you that we do. You know, we would love your support. We love your likes and your shares. We love your comments. Even if you're going to troll us, we're okay with that.
Yep, that's fine.
We're big boys.
Tell us what
we want. Your feedback. We definitely want your shares. And if you want to, you know, hook us up with a coffee, buy me a coffee at freshpulpmag.com.
Oh, afraid that we have it.
Or Patreon for both of us. And we are going to again. We're doing the giveaway. We talked about that. So
loot boxes. So
the loot crates. Stay tuned for that. Thank you for tuning in. And we will see you.
Yes, we will.